I've been home for almost 4 months, which means I've burned through a lot of Netflix. And Netflix and I have gotten to know each other pretty well. It usually knows what I want to watch before I do. Quirky, heartfelt teen dramas, binge-worthy shows featuring a strong female lead, critically acclaimed documentaries. And every time I choose a show, Netflix gets smarter. But how smart? What does it mean for an algorithm or a human to be intelligent?
This is Carry the One.
Carry the One Radio, the science podcast.
Igniting scientific curiosity.
From the University of California,
San Francisco.
Hi, and welcome to Carry the One Radio. I'm Celia, and today we're talking about brains. Real squishy human brains and confusing, misunderstood robot brains. We picked the brains of three computational neuroscientists. They use biology, computer science, and math to study how we think and how we can make computers think too. Meet Kim Stockenfeld.
I'm a research scientist at DeepMind on the neuroscience team. And I took a philosophy course my first year, and one of the problems they introduced as a sort of thought experiment was this problem of how you would design a robot that could be given very abstractly specified goals, such as there's a building on fire, go try and fix the problem. Either maybe save people from the building, maybe put out the fire, just somehow render this goal of making things better onto a series of actionable steps that eventually render themselves in the form of putting one foot in front of the other.
Designing a robot that can do anything sounds so cool at first, but on second thought, it's a little scary.
There's a lot of strong intuitions about AI that relate to fears, or a lot of times relate to like a sense of identity as a human and the idea that a machine could never have whatever thing someone thinks is unique to humans, and that changes over time. Sometimes it's emotions, sometimes it's consciousness, sometimes it's intelligence, but we're kind of knocking that one down.
That's Grace Lindsay.
I'm a postdoc researcher at University College London, specializing in computational neuroscience research.
We also talked with Dan Yeamans,
professor of computer science and psychology and a faculty scholar at the Wu Tsai Neurosciences Institute at Stanford.
We asked him to help us understand what artificial intelligence, or AI, actually means.
Artificial intelligence is basically being able to mimic human behavior without having to go through the process of constructing a new human, you know, the biological way, but instead with low-cost, kind of easy-to-construct procedures that we know how to describe. So typically that will mean like a computer program.
Computer programs perform functions. They turn inputs into outputs. So a computer program designed to label pictures might take in a picture of a puppy and then spit out the word puppy. We see image recognition programs like that all the time. But we also know that AI does so much more than puppy labeling. Here's Grace again.
The goalpost for AI is on wheels. Like, anytime you get, like, someone says, like, okay, if you can make a machine that can play chess, wow, now we've got an intelligent machine. And then someone does it and is like, yeah, well, it played chess, but can it drive a car? Like, it just gets moved back. Every time you get through that goal, the goalpost gets moved. And so I think if we're being honest about what has been labeled intelligence in the past and kind of what benchmarks were set so that we could say, like, oh, it'll be pretty impressive if a machine can do this, like, those things are being surpassed. There are machines that can play board games like chess or Go, or even video games at levels that exceed human level. And if we now retroactively say, oh, that's actually not impressive, like, that's just us updating our sense of what is uniquely human intelligence. But it's not actually based on some ground truth belief about what intelligence is. It's just anytime a machine can do it, it's not called intelligence anymore.
So what do we consider uniquely human intelligence?
Natural or biological intelligence is just the behavior of organisms. You know, I don't know that I want to distinguish between intelligence and stupidity as right. much as it's just like there's behavior of organisms, and behavior can be characterized and measured. So for me, it's more behavior than intelligence. But if you include all of human behavior, then you're going to catch intelligence in there. because I don't want to make a bright line between, like, you know, the parts of the behavior that are intelligent and the parts that aren't exactly.
Okay, so Dan says that human intelligence is whatever makes human behavior possible, and artificial intelligence is whatever makes human-like behavior possible in a non-human thing. Those aren't quite the same, but...
What's different about them? Well, I'm not 100% sure. I wish I knew. Part of the problem is figuring that out.
Kim said that differences between human and artificial intelligence start to bubble up when we do things like...
Playing a video game? At every point in time, you see something on the screen, and you can manipulate the controls in a way that lets you move around and see different things on the screen and explore different aspects of the game environment. Every once in a while, you get something that's really rewarding in the context of the game.
Like a gold coin. One way that we learn is through a process that computational neuroscientists call reinforcement learning.
Reinforcement learning means you only learn when you see something really rewarding that happens.
You learn to repeat actions that lead to good things. If you smash a mysterious box and a valuable gold coin appears, then you're gonna go smash some more mysterious boxes. But if a bunch of angry snakes fell out of that box instead, if you're smart, you'll take it easy on the box smashing.
If agents play this game and don't really remember anything at all until they get to some reward, they can still figure out how to send that information through the environment so that they can make decisions at all the right places.
When Kim talks about agents, she's not talking about secret agents or the people finding jobs for actors playing secret agents. In the AI world, an agent is just anything that perceives and reacts to the world. We're all agents. And the agent that we're talking about here is a computer program that perceives this video game world and then reacts accordingly, running around, collecting coins.
The problem with this is that you end up throwing away a lot of the information about your environment.
Okay, so say that this is a pretty boring game and the agent only has two options. From some starting position, they can either move left or move right. Before the game starts, neither move seems obviously better. Say that out of 100, each move gets 50 goodness points. But if the agent moves left and finds a coin, those points are going to shift. Maybe now move left gets 54 goodness points, and move right only has 46. So the next time the agent has to choose which way to move, taking a left looks a little more appealing. It has more points. And we keep going until these points balance out in a way that gets the agent to make moves that lead to the most coins. This process works, but again, it's not particularly efficient. Kim explains more.
If you had to learn science by not seeing which answers you got right or wrong, or not having somebody explain to you the material, and just seeing how many points you got on a test, not even necessarily knowing how many points it was out of, that would be a really laborious way to learn something very complicated and difficult. I'm sure it would take more than a human lifetime. Humans come to every task with a lot more knowledge than a machine learning algorithm comes to a task with. When you come to a task, you already know what a coin is, and you have some prior assumption that coins are going to be valuable. You also, whenever you see a coin, you associate it with all the other coins. So even if you didn't necessarily know that coins were valuable, the first time you touched a coin and found out that it gave you lots of points, you would immediately generalize this to all the other coins as well. You have prior information about how you should group different states and features together and learn about them all at the same time. And this kind of like folding up of your experiences, where you group lots of experiences that are different together and learn about them all at the same time, makes humans really efficient. The main things I think of humans as and animals as being better than computers at is really this kind of flexible reasoning, where you can reuse information that you've learned in one context in another context.
Like, if I have money in real life, I can exchange it for rewarding things like ice cream or new clothes. I know that money gives me the ability to have nice things. I also know that money comes in many different forms. I have credit cards, dollar bills, and coins. So when I see a coin in a video game, my brain automatically links that coin with the concept of money, which I know is good. I don't need to learn what coins are for all over again. Instead, I'm reusing information I learned in the real world in this new video game world, which, not to brag, is pretty flexible of me.
Yeah, whenever you move through the world, you learn a lot about the world even though it's not intrinsically rewarding. And humans are curious. Humans are motivated to learn things about the world that aren't necessarily obviously rewarding. They don't necessarily lead to more money or finding more fruit juice in your house. but they're things that we find satisfying and a worthwhile pursuit. And that's because trying to discover knowledge in the world seems like it's a really good first step in order to be able to perform well later on. Oftentimes, the agents that are produced with this kind of training can achieve really sophisticated levels of performance, but are really specialized.
Kim spends a lot of time thinking about these agents. She works for DeepMind, a team of researchers affiliated with Google who are constantly in the news for making wild breakthroughs in AI. Back in 2017, DeepMind introduced an agent named AlphaZero that taught itself how to play Go and chess from scratch, and beat human champions at both games.
An agent that's trained to play Go can get really, really good at Go, but it won't necessarily find metaphors from Go to the real world or use something it learned about Go to inform its strategy about chess. So if you hear an agent is really, really good at Go, that doesn't necessarily mean it's going to also be good at every other human faculty that we would think of as easier than Go. It just means that we made something that's really, really good at Go, which is hard to do. So we can be really excited about it. But it's different from artificial general intelligence just because this breadth of transferable skills is not necessarily implied by getting good at one particular task.
People like DeepMind researchers pick games like Go and chess because they think artificial agents can do them. These games involve lots of quick calculations and following rules, things computers are pretty good at. These days, a computer can probably beat you at crazy hard games that 20 years ago we thought required super special human intelligence to conquer. But like Kim said, just because a computer can play Go doesn't mean it can do something that we'd think of as way easier. Like those tests some websites make you take to prove you're not a robot. We can smoke computers at saying whether or not a picture contains traffic lights. And we don't need 8 million attempts to figure out the rules of chess. We can learn the basics in an afternoon. Unlike artificial agents, we can learn quickly because we carry a lot of general knowledge around with us at all times. We're smart. We are awesome. Humans can do anything! But I digress. All three of our guests describe themselves as computational neuroscientists, which means that there must be some overlap between the study of biological brains and the study of computers and how they work. Dan explained.
I would say there's three things. There's neurons in the brain, then there's behavior, like psychology, and then there's computer algorithms and neural networks and things. And I feel like at the moment, the like flows here are that cognitive science really helps inform AI. It tells you what good tasks are and what very high level ideas about behavior are obviously good directions for AI to kind of go solve.
So we have computer algorithms and neural networks and things, but what is a neural network? Dan's talking about a machine learning tool that's loosely inspired by the human brain. Our brains are made up of billions of interconnected cells called neurons. When your brain gets a signal from the outside world, like light coming into your eyeball, it gets passed from neuron to neuron in this ultra-fast game of telephone, turning that input into an output that tells your body what to do next. In machine learning, neural networks are made up of connections between artificial neurons that are organized in layers, kind of like they are in your brain. Input goes into the bottom layer and works its way up to the top layer, transforming along the way. We'll hear some more about how neural networks learn in a bit, but first, Dan and Kim told us more about how machine learning, artificial intelligence, and neuroscience work together.
I think of artificial intelligence as being a set of problems and machine learning as a set of techniques, typically.
Both the fields are so fun right now. Like neuroscience and machine learning are just, yeah, very, very central problems in the scientific world. I think that the link is that they're trying to ask similar questions. For really, the machine learning version of the problem is, how do we make agents that do this. And the neuroscience problem is, how do we understand the process whereby humans and animals do this? So how do we understand how humans and animals use their memories, and how can we build agents that also effectively use their memories? For every machine learning problem, there's a neuroscience version of it. But those problems are importantly different in that getting something to work and understanding how it works turned out to be really different problems.
In a lot of ways, neuroscience, psychology, and AI depend on each other. But like all good relationships, theirs has evolved over time.
And that's kind of happened throughout history, is they've gotten closer together and further apart and been of, you know, different levels of interest to each other throughout.
Neuroscience, over the very long and sort of slow osmotic sense, really helped develop a very important piece of AI technology. Today, however, I don't usually find it as natural to go from neuroscience to AI directly, because a lot of observations in neuroscience are not so broad as those. Over the more recent term, what I do find helpful for AI is thinking about psychology, thinking about cognition. What are people doing, and like, what are the qualities of what they seem to be interested in and what they do? We should solve those behaviors from an AI perspective.
And now the relationship between neuroscience and AI is kind of coming full circle.
The field of neuroscience is becoming increasingly reliant on mathematical and computational methods.
Like, there's a lot of massive brain data. It's extremely difficult to interpret by looking at it. But what's been really interesting is seeing how cognitively driven AI models help you make sense of brain data.
It's all pretty meta. So scientists used their brains to figure out enough about their brains to build something inspired by brains. But that thing doesn't look anything like a brain, and now it's used to interpret data from actual brains. What?
We're all just a big piece of this cosmic puzzle called life.
Even with all of these exciting connections between neuroscience and AI, we're still pretty stumped. It turns out that recreating the brain, biologically speaking, is really, really hard.
We don't know how all the pieces of the brain fit together yet, so there's something in the brain that the models are missing, but how to actually translate that into the models at this point in the game is not always clear.
Quick reminder, our brains are made up of a bunch of cells called neurons. Each neuron forms thousands of connections with other neurons, and there are almost 100 billion neurons in the brain. When things are that complicated...
Most of the time, when you try to make the model more biologically plausible, you make it perform worse. If you try to kind of put in a new piece, like, oh, well, I know that the brain does X with its real neurons, so I'm going to put that into my model. But it turns out that the usefulness of that thing that the brain does depends on 10 other things that it also does, and your model doesn't have those things, then you can actually just break the whole thing. So the idea is presumably that someday, when we understand the brain well enough, obviously a more brain-like model will be better, because our brains are currently better than how these models can perform.
Neuroscientists are on their way to understanding how individual neurons talk to each other, which is great, but there are billions of them making thousands of connections. That's trillions of connections. So if you want to build a brain-like model,
you have to figure out a way to actually determine how the different fake neurons in this network connect to each other, like development from when you're an infant. The actual way in which the system is getting pieced together to be able to function at all. That happens slowly over time. You know, normally when you learn, you have to be exposed to something repeatedly. And really what neuroscientists think is happening for most of that learning process is that the connections between your real neurons are changing. So this idea of learning being associated with changing the way that neurons connect, that's true in the artificial networks, and it's true in real networks as well. So you have all these artificial neurons. They turn their inputs into output, and they all connect to each other. So one neuron gets input from other neurons, and the neurons, depending on how much input they get, that determines how much output they give. So kind of their activity level is their output. There's specific numbers that represent how strongly these neurons connect to each other. But then how you connect them is through something called a weight. So if I have one neuron who's got an activity level of 5, and it connects to another neuron with a weight of 2, then the total input it gives to that other neuron is 10. So you just multiply the activity of the neuron by this number called the weight, and then that tells it how much it influences this other neuron. And you do this millions of times in these networks because there's a lot of neurons and they're all connected to each other in different ways. And so the learning in the network, or training, or however you want to refer to it, is the process of determining what those weight values should be. What should the strength of the connections between neurons be? And that determines kind of how the whole network works. That's basically what it comes down to, is the connections between these neurons. So that's what you have to figure out how to get done. And it's a hard problem because there's a lot of these weights in the network, and you would have no idea just sitting there looking at it like, oh, I think if that weight goes up, then the network will be better able to identify dogs.
Imagine each weight is a knob that can strengthen or weaken the connection between two neurons. Now imagine staring at a control board with millions of knobs, zero labels, and something is making a machine think that dogs are spaghetti. There's a magic combination of knob turns that will tell this machine what a dog looks like, but where would you even start? Does unlabeled knob number 376 give you dog identification vibes?
There's no kind of logical way to think it through. So you need these algorithms that do it automatically. And you need to figure that out, otherwise the model doesn't work well. And so there is a belief that if we could figure out how the brain is learning, then we would have kind of a super-powered meta way of making AI that can kind of do anything, because that's the beauty of a system that learns, is you just have to show it examples and it'll get better. And so if we could learn as well as humans can learn in these artificial systems, then that would be a pretty big step forward.
Kim talked more about this.
I think we used to think of human intelligence as just strictly more sophisticated and more complicated than neural networks or machine learning algorithms could compete with. And now machine learning algorithms can do really complicated and sophisticated stuff, but they just do so efficiently and they don't necessarily generalize their knowledge. There's sort of this interesting trade-off where a lot of the things that seem really easy for humans to do, like object recognition and facial recognition, were things that were really hard to get machine learning algorithms to do. So I think a lot of the times the things that we find harder are not necessarily the things that are hard for machines.
Image recognition algorithms are everywhere now. Your phone might try to separate pictures of your friends from pictures of your cat, or outline the faces of friends you should tag on social media. But sometimes these algorithms are comically incorrect, like saying that your cat picture contains mountain? What's going on there? Dan told us more about how artificial agents perceive the world.
Maybe you could say that the artificial agents are better at the earlier, more perceptual parts and not yet really mastered the sort of scene description or shape, and certainly not yet really good at like robustly understanding how to decide what to interact with in the world or how to interact with people.
Dan gave us an example.
Machines are great at recognizing and reading barcodes, and they've been better than humans at that for decades.
Right. Imagine looking at 20 barcodes and trying to match them to 20 things in a shopping cart. It would be almost impossible. To our human brains, all barcodes kind of look the same. But like Kim said earlier, artificial agents are great at super specialized tasks like this, but bad at branching out. A machine that's great at recognizing barcodes would be terrible at recognizing anything else. Have you seen a self-checkout barcode scanner do anything other than scan barcodes?
The types of algorithms that are good at that are actually terrible at dogs and boats and the things humans are good at.
We can look at pretty much any object and describe what it looks like, what it's used for, and how it makes us feel. We're always carrying around a stash of general knowledge, and it gives us a leg up sometimes. So humans and machines, we have our own talents.
I think it's a mixed bag at the moment. But I would say that like describing the tasks on which they're better or worse is like a good proxy for whatever the deeper differences are. But there's some difference in the goal for which they were trained that causes them to be different, probably. Part of the problem is figuring that out.
There's one super obvious link between humans and AI that we haven't mentioned yet. Humans write the code. We teach the machines. There are so many ways to go about this, but like Grace mentioned earlier, teaching artificial neural networks involves fine-tuning the connections between their artificial neurons, the same thing our brains do as they learn and grow. Kim also talked about training artificial agents through reinforcement learning. As a reminder,
Reinforcement learning is learning from reward. Basically, it involves using trial and error to try and see which outcomes were rewarding and repeating actions that led to rewarding outcomes. If you did something and then something good happened, you should do more of that thing.
Like how we learned to collect coins in Super Mario. But what if we dive into this method a little deeper? What if we blend the weight tuning Grace talked about with the trial and error learning Kim's talking about?
Deep reinforcement learning is a combination of these features. We basically take our neural network, which is this stacked layer of multiple processing steps, and we tune all of the different parameters in that model. So for instance, if you want some model that's going to turn pictures of cats into labels that say cat, you can gradually change all of these weights over many, many exposures to different pictures of cats and pictures of things that are not cats so that your model is more likely to produce the correct label for the matching image.
So the model will decrease weights between neurons that made it more likely to call a banana a cat or call a cat a banana. Likewise, it will increase weights between neurons that helped it do a good job.
The way you can pair this with reinforcement learning is you can train a model where now you're changing the weights to make actions that tend to lead to rewarding outcomes more likely and actions that lead to less rewarding outcomes less likely. One of the reasons we really like reinforcement learning is because it's a very autonomous form of learning. We want machine learning methods that work for cases where we don't necessarily know what the right answers are. We can maybe say, wow, that was really good. That was even better than something I came up with. And we can reward an agent for doing a good job, but we can't always say in domains that surpass our understanding what the right answer is. And even when we can, it might be kind of laborious to do so.
While we've been sheltering in place, many of us, myself included, have been guilty of spending lots of time scrolling through Instagram. All the pictures that we've liked and shared, they're actually matrices. On our phones, each image is a matrix composed of pixels. A matrix can be, for example, 1,000 pixels wide and 1,000 pixels tall. Each of those pixels is represented by a set of three color channels, red, green, and blue, RGB.
So a convolutional neural network is something that basically takes in a thing of the form space by space by channel, applies a little local transformation at each point in the image.
Let's say we're looking at a beautiful loaf of sourdough bread on Instagram. A convolutional neural network will break that picture down into pixels, where each pixel is located somewhere along the width and height of the picture, and it has some RGB color value. So we look at one pixel at a time, then
you kind of drag the local transformation along, in parallel applying it at every location, okay, everywhere in the image.
We zoom in on each pixel and its neighbors, like a teeny crumb in the corner of our loaf of bread. Then we do a little math.
Then there's some kind of, like, thresholding operation, like you cut off all the values below something, and you do again and again and again.
So our neural network is sliding along this picture, transforming one crumb at a time. What we get, in the end, no longer looks like an Instagram picture. Instead of being 1,000 by 1,000 pixels with the three color channels, we have something that's not quite a picture anymore. It's just a stack of channels. Originally, these channels only represented one basic feature of the image. Color. With way more channels, we can represent way more features.
And at the end, you have this one kind of thing that where the, each of the points are like more abstract features. They can't be quite named in English typically, but they might represent things like, is there an animal present? Zero or one? If there is one, if there's not zero. Or there might be represent things like, where is an object in the image? Is it in the upper left, the upper right, the lower left, lower right?
With the right combination of abstract features, we should be able to identify things. Maybe we can define sourdough as animal present, zero. Is the thing on a plate? One. Is it kind of round? One. And so on. It's like 20 questions, but with thousands of questions and only zero or one as answers. given these tools, how do we properly evaluate the success of an artificial agent? Is that even something we can do?
There's a famous phrase by a guy named George Box, who was a statistician, and it's that all models are wrong, but some are useful. The brain is made up of billions of neurons, and each of those neurons are incredibly complex cellular machines that have proteins and ion channels and all kinds of stuff. So you're always making some choice about which details you're including. And in some sense, you know, when we say something is biologically plausible, it's claiming that it uses a fair number of biological details. And the stronger constraint is that it doesn't use very many things that we don't think biology can do at all.
In other words, a biologically plausible model does its best to stick to the rules nature has already set for us. Like, a neuron can only talk to the neurons it's connected to. But scientists' understanding of these rules is still pretty limited.
And really, the question is, can the model explain what you want it to explain, given the details that it's using, so long as it's not using anything that we know is impossible for the brain to do? It's nice if you can throw in the extra details and it still works, but detail for detail's sake is not really the goal. So you don't set the connections between the neurons, but this learning algorithm does. And so in the end, you have a network that works, but you didn't really build it exactly. The algorithm kind of built it. And so this question is like, why is it behaving the way that it is? Could I do experiments on the model the same way I would do experiments on the brain and get something sensible out?
All right. So if these artificial agents don't end up functioning like human brains, does that mean we failed?
The building blocks of human cognition will be really important to getting intelligent behavior. There might be really fundamentally different ways of building intelligence, but we already have this example of human and animal intelligence that seems to work quite well. So scaffolding our engineering efforts off of that seems to make a lot of sense.
But sometimes engineers just want to build machines that get stuff done, whether they're inspired by human cognition or not. When you look under the hood of an artificial agent, the thing making it tick probably won't look anything like a human brain. So are there multiple ways to build intelligence? Can we build Westworld-quality AI that behaves exactly like us without relying on the building blocks of human cognition and neuroscience? We asked Dan.
If the problem is hard, there are few solutions. If the problem is easy, there's a lot of solutions. So the harder the problem, the fewer the solutions. Therefore, the more likely any two solutions are to be similar. Therefore, it's more likely that an AI solution will be similar to the human solution.
And as humans, we're biased. We're biased towards interpreting the inner workings of AI through this human psychology lens. Human intelligence is the only form of intelligence we have introspective experience with. In Kim's words,
if something's inarticulable, it's really hard to code up a thing that does it.
To create or build anything new, we have to start from somewhere we know. Dan told us more about one major source of AI inspiration, babies.
The most compelling version of that for me now is like thinking about what infants do. Infants do a lot of very powerful learning things that are not paralleled in computers yet, in AI yet. And if we could figure out how to make AI systems that act like a 12-month-old or can go on a spectrum from like a 4-month-old to an 18-month-old, I think we've made a huge progress. And that's like the right direction for pointing our AI. Cognition and experiments in like infant cognition give us some pretty good constraints on what to do with AI systems.
But that's the thing about humans. We keep growing. Our infant brains develop into smarter, more angst-ridden adult brains. If we model AI systems off of human infants, can they then keep getting smarter? Or is there a limit to how intelligent AI can get? Kim said,
I don't see why there would have to be a limit. It is certainly my dream that we come up with agents that are capable of learning structure from arbitrary domains. I think the inner hidden reasons that I love this problem and I'm working in this area is there's actually some underlying structure pattern to it. I think perhaps the limitation would come when there just isn't underlying structure to be uncovered. So even a very sophisticated pattern extracting algorithm can't find anything because it's just not there to be found. But there's certainly like no obvious bottleneck in my mind for why we wouldn't be able to get agents that can learn structure from really abstract and complicated problems that defy human categorization.
Another tricky problem is figuring out how to interpret what all these algorithms are doing. Grace and Kim explain.
You have a network that works, but you didn't really build it exactly. The algorithm kind of built it. Is there anything you can say about its guts that can help people understand it? Like, if the algorithm is going to be deployed in the real world, they want some way to, like, explain to customers why the algorithm made the decision that it made or something like that.
Oftentimes, a machine has achieved a solution that's really good and maybe better than the things we could hard code up ourselves. The reason it gets this improvement is because it's learned something that's maybe a little bit better than what we had language to specify. The real challenge is that if you want superhuman performance in your agent, and that's usually the point of having an agent in the first place, it's hard to also express what it's doing in human understandable terms. It's a really, really important problem, though, because if you have machines that are engaged in the real world and making really important decisions, then you want to know how it's making those decisions, and you want to make sure that it's using fair and reasonable rules for making its decisions, and not exploiting biases in the data that came out of human behaviors that we're not especially proud of.
Oof. Yeah. Can't say we're known for our super equitable, totally unbiased decision making.
A good example would be if you have some machine learning algorithm that's trying to predict something about people, maybe whether you should hire them or not, or whether you should give them a loan, or some decision that really affects people's lives. And you train this model based on the statistics of who applied in the past and who was hired in the past, or who applied for a loan and got the loan. And this data might be riddled with factors of bias, maybe racial bias or gender bias. And you don't want to be making decisions based on those criteria, even though they might have affected human decision making in the past. So trying to remove those influences from the data set can be a really challenging problem, but is a really, really important problem too.
We have this opportunity to teach artificial agents to make better decisions than we do. It's a do what I say, not what I do situation.
People are researching this problem of fairness in AI and trying to get algorithms that are more transparent and can be, and that you can say, like, however you make your decision, I want to make sure that it's invariant to the gender of the applicant or to the race of the applicant or some other feature that you might want to control for. This is another one of the reasons that there's increasing emphasis on having more diversity in tech in general, because the thinking is that if there's more diversity among the people building these algorithms, they'll be more sensitive to cases when your model is making obvious errors and is really not paying attention to the features it should and paying attention to more features it shouldn't. There should be very principled ways of catching these. I think that's the hope, but certainly sanity checks would catch them better if there's good representation among the people building them.
No matter how hard to understand the inner workings of a model become, a human still created it. And as long as humans are writing the rules that guide our algorithms, we need to make sure that those humans are representative of all humans, not just the cast of Silicon Valley. This idea extends beyond the engineers writing the code. It's also important, for example, that journalists convey AI-related information to the public responsibly.
I would say that almost all reporting on AI is by virtue of having an agenda of either like making people scared or getting people interested in reading the article, typically not that good at representing where the state of affairs really is. And so there was a self-driving car that hit a pedestrian and killed them. I don't think it was well described in that article whether or not a normal driver, a human driver, would have done the same thing in that circumstance. And I think it matters a lot whether that's true. So I think that it was the media's responsibility to investigate whether or not there was a natural flaw in AI that led to it, or whether it was a circumstance that was unavoidable due to the nature of the event. I think that's an example of a situation where I feel like it's very easy to be like, well, let's be scared of what this is.
With all our binge watching, from classics like Terminator and Ex Machina to newer shows like Westworld, we're pretty familiar with this robot apocalypse trope. Are these movies onto something? Is the human race actually doomed to obsolescence? Grace and Dan had some thoughts.
Well, there's a lot of thoughts and talk about AI is going to want to rule us all and enslave us. I don't think that there's much logic to that. I'm more sympathetic to the idea of like big corporations will unleash algorithms on the world before they're quite ready. That seems like that could have more subtle negative consequences that I understand people need to be on the lookout for. So, but the big scary Terminator style future, I think, is a little silly.
You know, if you look in this movies in the 70s about computers, there's this movie called Colossus. I don't know if you guys have seen it. It's just a 70s B movie about this computer that was going to take over the world and like set off nuclear bombs. People were afraid of that.
The choice is yours. Obey me and live, or disobey and die.
So what has happened with computers is not that. But what instead, it's not that big dramatic event, but instead now computers have totally changed the fact of shopping so that instead of having like brick and mortar stores, we have like click for ordering toilet paper and diapers and things. And that's like an enormous change in the lives of everybody in terms of the employment structure, in terms of what you do with your time, in terms of where you go. It's like enormous, right? But it's very mundane. I think it's going to be like that, but I don't know exactly how.
Artificial intelligence is more powerful than we ever imagined it could be, and still, in many ways, really, really stupid. AI has restructured our economy and reshaped our social interactions, yet only sometimes correctly labels pet pictures on your phone. We've learned that humans and computers have their own strengths and weaknesses, and humans have the power to harness the strengths of computers for good. But what if the computers take over and use their strengths for evil?
People who don't know about it are often convinced that like apocalypse is right around the corner, but things are very far away from being able to do that. Somebody, but I'm not sure whom, it is that said that like things in the future change both much less radically and much more radically than people expect. The differences in our everyday lives will probably, 50 years from now be very substantial, but they maybe seem more mundane than like a robot apocalypse or something.
It's not a robot apocalypse. It's Amazon. This episode was written and produced by Devika Nair, Lee Wong, Ben Mansky, and myself, Celia Ford, with editing help from the rest of the team at Carry the One Radio. Huge thanks to Dan Yeamans, Kim Stockenfeld, and Grace Lindsay for speaking with us. And if you like what you heard, please share, subscribe, leave a rating, tell a friend, you know the drill. And if you need more non-COVID-19 related science content to fill the void, head to carrytheoneradio.com. Over 100 episodes are there waiting for you. Last but not least, we're very grateful for our science producers Sama Ahmed, Carly Van Orsdel, Janine Cuevas, Judith Horn, and David Cabral for supporting us. You can be a science producer too. Just donate what you can to the show at patreon.com/carrytheone. Until next time, goodbye, stay well, and stay curious.